Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 18th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. Events in the last 2 weeks in Dallas, Texas have brought to the forefront an issue that for too long has been treated in the United States as almost a non-story, as something at least that's far removed from the reality facing most Americans. I'm speaking about the Ebola virus. This changed with the death at a Dallas hospital on October 8th of Thomas Duncan, who came here from Liberia. And his death has been followed by reports of two nurses who worked with him at the hospital who have been diagnosed with Ebola. This is a disease which is spreading very rapidly in the African countries of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. It is projected that as many as 1.5 million people may be infected by the end of the year, and the death rate of those infected now is over 70%. Yet the official line from President Obama and those who serve under him is that you shouldn't worry. You're protected. Our system will take care of you, and it can't happen here. But Lyndon LaRouche this last week warned that unless there's an emergency mobilization that can begin to bring down the death rate, human civilization may be wiped out by this new plague. And many Americans are beginning to pay attention. Firstly, because they know you can't trust anything that Obama says, but also because there are many people in the United States, including in key institutional positions, who are well aware of the accuracy of Mr. LaRouche's forecasts on this question over many, many years, and are beginning to become aware that there's a deliberate commitment among leading members of the British monarchy and their allies and puppets, including Barack Obama, to eliminate a large segment of the human population. Joining me on the program today to discuss this is Dr. Deborah Hanania Freeman. Dr. Freeman is the national spokesman for Lyndon LaRouche. She has a doctorate from Johns Hopkins University in public health, and she's written extensively in the Executive Intelligence Review on these matters, which affect your probability of survival. And there's also on LaRouchePack.com an interview done by Debbie, I think, yesterday. So, Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Harley. It's good to be here.
Well, let's begin with an update on where things stand at the moment, as you know, in the Ebola outbreak, both the danger it represents and also then get into this current state of global preparedness to prevent this from becoming a biological holocaust.
Well, I will say that the recent events in Texas that forced this issue into the headlines here in the United States, in that sense, at least forced attention on something that people should have been concerned about months ago. But the problem that we face right now is that if you pick up any newspaper, you look at any news program, there is a tremendous amount of talk about what we are doing here in the United States. And of course, this last week you had emergency hearings on Capitol Hill on the question, which led to some people putting out an absolutely ridiculous call for sealing our borders, essentially, for invoking travel bans. And less attention is being paid to what really has got to be addressed, which is the fact that this pandemic is completely out of control in Africa, and it is getting worse by the minute. And people just have to face the facts. There is no way that you are going to stop a further catastrophe, including a catastrophe in the United States, if we do not contain Ebola on the continent of Africa. We have to stop the epidemic now. And there is not enough being done. Obama has made a lot of noise about this. He's criticized other nations for not taking action. And it just is one more thing to put on top of the pile of lies that he is telling, because we are not doing nearly enough and not nearly what could be done. And I just want to emphasize that this catastrophe could have been avoided. There was no reason why this outbreak had to be allowed to get completely out of control.
Debbie, when did you first become aware of the outbreak, and how long has this been something that's been discussed by Médecins Sans Frontières and some of the other groups?
Well, the outbreak got really serious in March of this year. At that time, various groups like Doctors Without Borders and also the governments of the three countries involved realized that what they were dealing with was something that was a potential catastrophe. Because prior to March of this year, there had been 18 outbreaks of this particular strain of Ebola. But in each instance, those outbreaks were in small mining villages. And while they were very deadly, they were containable.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened in March was that cases started to break out in the capital cities of the countries involved. These are densely populated areas. They're areas with absolutely zero infrastructure. And you're dealing with the three poorest countries in all of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the presidents of those countries, as well as Doctors Without Borders, sounded the alarm and said, hey, we've got to act on this right now. Those pleas were ignored. But even more seriously, one of the things that has come to light recently is that when Obama was first elected president in 2008, the Centers for Disease Control actually did an extensive report, which was forwarded to the transition team, that went through the fact that under the Bush presidency, global capabilities to fight disease had been taken down to such a degree that in the immediate period ahead, the world was threatened by the outbreak of pandemics and that we would be in no position to respond. Obama received those memoranda, and what did he do? Well, what he did was he imposed cuts that were even more drastic than the cuts we saw under the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. So on many different fronts, this is a catastrophe that could have been foreseen. And of course, I could also point out that it was in the early 1970s when the IMF first began to impose their murderous austerity in Africa and other parts of the developing sector, that LaRouche formed the Biological Holocaust Task Force. And one of the things that was warned about then is that if these policies were imposed, that you would turn the developing sector, and particularly Africa, into a giant petri dish, into the lushest possible environment for the growth of any number of different epidemics, both by producing brand new viruses, as we saw with HIV, and by essentially creating the conditions where we would see new forms of old viruses that would be even more deadly. And, you know, this is one of those instances where I really hate to say that LaRouche was right. But these policies were imposed in the 70s. They have been in play for almost 50 years now. And the world is paying the consequences.
And Debbie, when you talk about these conditionalities, one of the most important aspects of it is that governments are told they can't spend money on the basic infrastructure which would protect them from these diseases.
Exactly. You also do have a condition, and I think that, you know, there's a lesson to be learned in this for the United States. Because of all kinds of civil unrest and other developments, all kinds of localized wars, especially in Sierra Leone, what occurred was that the new governments that came in were faced with no alternative, at least in their mind, than to privatize. And what you had was, in especially Sierra Leone and Liberia, you had massive privatization where the nation's forests were sold to private interests, largely to British and Dutch mining companies that cut down everything. There's massive deforestation. And this is actually what led to these outbreaks to begin with. Because and I should just mention, I mean, the reason why you had the deforestation is because they moved in with just incredible strip mining. It was real primitive accumulation. And these forests, which housed the bats, the fruit bats, which were known as the principal carriers of Ebola, had no place to go. So that for the first time, you had this incredible influx of these bats into densely populated areas. Some of the people who have come back from Liberia and who have come back from Sierra Leone have said that in the capital cities, what you're seeing there is similar to what you see in certain coastal cities in the United States, where you have horrible problems of rat infestation. This has been a long-time problem in cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, where the rat population far outweighs the human population. But now in Liberia, in these other countries, you're seeing it with bats. The streets are littered with dead bats, which means that the potential transmission from bat to human, the species jump, was there. Now, some people will say, oh, that's because, you know, these crazy Africans eat the bats. Now, it is true that some of that does go on, but you don't have to eat an infected bat to contract a disease. It's you know, people are inhaling the debris, the waste, the feces. It's just a complete nightmarish situation. But
actually, sounds like the spread of the Black Plague in the 1300s.
Well, I'll tell you something. During the period of the Black Death, Italy had better infrastructure than these countries have right now. Mm-hmm. And that is, it's unfathomable, but it happens to be true. The cities in Italy where the Black Death took half the population actually did have sewage capabilities and things like that. In these areas, you have nothing. And keep in mind, I mean, in a country like Liberia, three-quarters of the forests were cut down by these British and Dutch mining companies. It's the result, in the most dramatic way, of privatization. And it didn't have to happen. And I'm not saying that had that not happened, that we wouldn't have come up with some other kind of problem. But you just look at this from every standpoint. And I will say that right now we are facing the likelihood of a tremendous increase in the presence of the epidemic in countries outside of these three countries. We've already identified, depending on whose study you take, 13 to 21 other African countries that are immediately in danger. And again, why is this? Well, you know, during, I would say, probably from July to October, you have people who come into these three countries to help with the harvests. as soon as the harvest is over in October, they then go east and they go north. They go back to the mines, and then they go also to the coca plantations. They work in illegal charcoal operations. They even get involved in some fishing. But this kind of migration is what characterizes the area and has for decades. So that the idea that Ebola will be somehow contained to these three countries is a joke. It's not going to happen. As these young men move, they will carry the virus with them, and there is no way to stop it. The only way to stop it is to actually contain the virus by providing adequate treatment and by bringing down the death rate. And right now, we're not doing what we have to do to accomplish that.
Now, Debbie, you had said earlier that it could have been avoided or could have been stopped in an early phase. What would that have entailed, and what does that tell us about what we have to do now to bring down the death rate?
Well, back in March, what we could have done is we could have deployed sufficient medical personnel so that you could have provided treatment to people who were sick and employed the kind of classic public health measures, quarantine, contact tracing, that kind of thing. You still would have had a serious outbreak, but you wouldn't have the kind of exponential increase that you see now. For a little while, in July and August, when aid first started to flow into the area and people were getting some treatment, you started to see a small decrease in the death rate. The problem now is that as the infection has totally spread out of control, the death rate is climbing back up. And, you know, you have to keep in mind, when this started back in March, you take the country of Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone has a population of 6.5 million. There were a total of 300 hospital beds in the entire country. I'm not talking about hospital beds to treat Ebola. I'm talking about the total number of hospital beds. And you had a few dozen doctors. Now, it was at that point that aid should have flooded that country, and it didn't. Now you have a situation where, in the midst of this catastrophe, they've successfully established more hospital beds. There are 327 hospital beds dedicated to treat Ebola patients in a country which has thousands of cases. The World Health Organization last week said that there was no point anymore in reporting the number of people infected because the healthcare personnel that have been moved in there are so overwhelmed that they can't even begin to record the number of cases. Half of the healthcare personnel who have come into the area, both people who are native to the countries involved, missionaries who have come in from other countries, themselves have experienced a 50% death rate because they don't have the most basic kind of protective clothing. In Sierra Leone, they have virtually given up on the question of providing beds for everyone who needs them. And I shouldn't say that they've given up. They are continuing to try to get the necessary treatment beds. They continue to plead for help. But because the rate of infection is so enormous, and because bodies are piling up in the streets, they have now moved to the distribution of home care kits. They're trying to get people not to come out of their houses if they're infected, but to stay home and let the family care for them. And they're delivering kits which include rubber gloves, surgical masks, Tylenol, and Gatorade, which is...
It's not going to work.
No, it definitely is not going to work.
Debbie, you know, there was a report in the New England Journal of Medicine, I'm sure you saw this, September 24th, on treating Ebola with current tools, which says that, just to make your point, that if you have the medical personnel and a certain amount of material resources, you can begin to reduce the death rate. I think it's important
Absolutely.
That people understand that it's not something that's hopeless.
No, it's not hopeless. The way that if you catch someone with an Ebola infection, the first thing that you do is you immediately begin the IV infusion of fluids with a high concentration of electrolytes, because the way that the disease progresses is that it in the first stages you have vomiting, really violent vomiting and diarrhea. That brings about a severe level of dehydration, which then leads to internal bleeding and organ failure. If you can begin infusing the patient and keep them hydrated, you can actually give the body some time to build up antibodies. It will still have a high death rate. There's no question about it. And it's made worse by the fact that you're dealing with people who have severely compromised immune systems. But you could bring, I mean, virtually overnight with treatment, you could probably bring the death rate down to below 50% and hopefully down to the level of 25%. But you've got to get the care in there, and you've got to make sure that your healthcare personnel have appropriate protection. And, you know, masks and gloves are not sufficient. You have to give people respirator hoods. You know, the lies that you have coming out that Ebola is difficult to catch, it's not highly contagious, is utter nonsense. As you can see by the rate of infection, not only in Africa, but by the healthcare personnel who were treating Thomas Duncan. I would also say, and I think that this is very important, everyone who's involved in this knows very well that many of the measures taken are taken right now for effect. This business of taking people's temperature at the airport is absolutely ludicrous. Half the people who die from Ebola never spike a fever. So
also, with flu season coming in the United States, there are going to be a lot of people walking around with fevers.
Well, you're going to have a lot of Americans, because despite the claims of Obamacare, for millions of impoverished Americans, the first line of medical treatment, the place that they go for primary care, is the emergency room. And, you know, when somebody's got the flu, they're going to turn up at an emergency room with symptoms that look very similar to Ebola.
Yeah.
There's just, and it's one of the reasons why I say that you do have to address the broader question. As far as Africa is concerned, you know, one of the things that Obama keeps pointing to is the fact that he has promised to send in 3,000 military personnel, and this last week he upped it to 4,000. But we have to look at what he's deployed them to do. He's deployed them to build 17 clinics with 100 beds each. That's 1,700 beds where in three countries where you have an epidemic which is out of control. It's also the case that he initiated that weeks ago, and we still don't have a single one of those clinics operational. Now, if you look at a map, look at the three countries that are the hardest hit right now, all of them are along the west coast of Africa. If you were serious about doing something about this, we have two fully equipped hospital ships in the United States that have 1,000 beds each. China has offered their hospital ships. Russia has done the same. Any advanced sector country that is not landlocked has hospital ships. Why would you not move those ships into the waters out, off the coast of those countries? You could, within the course of 6 days, provide more hospital beds than you could in 2 months of construction on land. And because they are offshore, you would have virtually instant quarantine.
Instead, yeah, you'd have an isolation from that, exactly.
Exactly. Instead, you're going to build these 100-bed units, which do not have tremendous capability to isolate the infection. It's good that people will get some treatment, but it's a very low-technology approach. In the United States, we only have, at this moment, we have 4 hospitals and about 20 beds that are level 4 isolation units. Now, Obama and Anthony Fauci and others keep saying, you don't need that. Our hospitals are fully capable of dealing with Ebola patients. But it's not true, as people in Texas are well aware. I mean, are we equipped? Look at what happened with the case of Thomas Duncan. He showed up at an emergency room with 103 fever. He was vomiting. He had diarrhea. He had severe stomach pains. He told them that he had just come here from Liberia. All of this was noted in the chart. But Thomas Duncan was a black foreigner with no insurance. So what did they do? They gave him Tylenol. I think they did give him some antibiotics, and they sent him home. It was only days later, when he was brought into the hospital by ambulance, that he was even tested for Ebola. That test took 3 days. The nurses involved in his treatment all along the way were gloved and masked. If you go into any emergency room in the United States, the personnel generally are gloved and masked. But that's not sufficient, because this is highly contagious. Then what did Obama say? Don't worry. It's a bad situation. It's a tragedy for Africa. But this is the United States. No one here is going to die of Ebola. But then Thomas Duncan died. Then people were told, yes, but we have quarantine capabilities. We're watching, we're monitoring the people who dealt with him. It's not a problem. But obviously it was a problem, because the first nurse took sick. Then what? Then you had, in what just showed the extent of the lying, when the second nurse took ill, what were the circumstances? She supposedly was being monitored, but she flew to Cleveland to plan a wedding. She did take sick when she was in Cleveland. She called the CDC and said, I wanted the nurses who treated Thomas Duncan. I'm in Cleveland. I have a fever. What should I do? Is it okay for me to fly home? Because her fever wasn't that high, they said. They told her it was fine. So she took another commercial flight. The next thing that came out is that one of the people who handled Duncan's body fluids in the lab, because they were taken off duty for 21 days, thought it was a good time to take a vacation. That person, and I believe her spouse, are on a cruise ship with hundreds of other passengers.
Actually, 3,600 other passengers on the cruise ship.
It's unbelievable. Now, what does CDC say? CDC says, first of all, Well, the reason why these people got infected is because they didn't follow the protocols. But we find out a few days later that there were no protocols. They didn't break protocol. They didn't have a protocol. As to the lie that these people were being, quote-unquote, monitored, CDC says, well, they were, but it was self-monitoring. Now, what is self-monitoring? I mean, I suppose that I'm self-monitoring, because if I come down with a fever of 102 degrees, I will say, oh, I have a fever. Or if I get violent diarrhea, I will notice that. Is that self-monitoring? This is absurd.
Well, and the nurse in Cleveland did self-monitor. She did find a fever. She called the CDC, and they said, don't worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is an outrage. The problem is, and it's, you know, you have a level of incompetence that is startling, but you can't even look at it in the small, because if you look at it from the top, if you look at the fact that since Obama has been president, look at the way that healthcare in general has been taken down. And I'm not just talking about the direct delivery of medical care. I'm also talking about public health parameters and the general standard of living of the population. They've all been brought down under the guise of budget cuts, sequestration. The World Health Organization, which right now is really coming under fire for having not handled the early stages of this epidemic appropriately, has had their budget cut by more than 30% in the last 5 years. Now, you can say that this is short-sighted policy, that this is incompetent policy, or you can take a closer look and you can say, perhaps this is really not an accident. When you have top people in the British financial establishment, including the Queen herself, talking repeatedly about the need to reduce the population of the planet and to reduce it drastically, well, maybe this is not so accidental. You know, for anybody, and I know that many of our listeners, you know, do listen to a lot of these conspirophile shows. People listen to Alex Jones and other such outlets. And right now, these outlets are in overdrive, saying that undoubtedly this is a man-made virus that was cooked up in the basement at Fort Detrick and unleashed. Minister Farrakhan has called this a race-based weapon of genocide. But, you know, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't have to work that way. All you have to do is impose the kinds of policies that have been imposed, and you'll get the same result. You don't have to cook up a virus and unleash it. Everybody is always talking about these labs in the basement. I don't know why everybody thinks these laboratories are underground. But
on the interview you did with LaRouche Pack, you brought up the fact that this became U.S. policy with Henry Kissinger's NSSM 200, which did target primarily Africa and parts of Ibero-America for population reduction, including talking about using food as a weapon, the withholding
That's
of
right.
food.
And, you know, the food question right now in the midst of this Ebola epidemic is, I mean, this is a massive, massive crisis. I know that today the United Nations started to move in the first shipments of emergency food supplies in Sierra Leone because people are starving to death. Hmm. They weren't getting what they needed in terms of food to begin with, but as the situation with the pandemic just leaped out of control, this became very severe. And one of the things that we have to look at is also the potential of what happens if this spreads not only outside of these three countries, which it's virtually certain to do on the continent, but what happens when this breaks out in South America, in Central America, and the Caribbean, which it's almost guaranteed to do. General Kelly, who handles the Southern Command for the U.S. military, has said we should act preemptively. And he was not talking about closing borders. But, you know, in any situation like this, you have a choice. You know, you can try to deal with a disaster after it occurs, which is always a defensive action, or you can take preemptive measures. It's one of the things that struck me so much with some of the actions taken by the new Indian head of state, Mr. Modi, who launched this Clean India campaign, which is something that he had planned on doing. He's been talking about this for quite some time. But that's exactly the kind of thing that you do, because anyone who looks at the spread of any past epidemic knows that these things tend to start in Africa, and which way do they go? Well, they spread to the Western Hemisphere via South America, and then they spread east into the Near East and the Far East. So for those countries, this is the time for them to begin to address their infrastructure problems, to begin things like Clean India campaigns. This is not rocket science here. I know that Dr. Osterholm has called for the equivalent of a Manhattan Project to begin to find a treatment and a vaccine for Ebola. And that is something which is desperately needed. You have a lot of research going on now. The problem is that all of it is done discreetly by different labs, different countries. You know, they're all in competition to find the appropriate vaccine, et cetera. But they're duplicating efforts. And you also have a problem of people rushing to begin testing on Africans, essentially as human guinea pigs, which, you know, has some real ethical questions involved. But if you brought all these countries together, all these scientists together, to provide care under one roof, first of all, you would establish a certain standard. You would remove the duplication of effort, which you really don't want to have happen, and you'd have very stringent peer review, as you did during the Manhattan Project. Under those circumstances, we could find a vaccine probably very quickly. But again, that's not going to happen with Obama in the presidency.
Well, you're listening to Deborah Freeman. Let me just cut you off for a second, Debbie, because I want to let people know who you are. This is Dr. Deborah Freeman, the national spokesman for Lyndon LaRouche, and she's also an expert on public health. And you can read her reports on this in the Executive Intelligence Review, the last three or four issues, and I know there'll be something in the next issue. Also, you can look on the LaRouchePack.com to see an interview with Debbie that was done, I believe, within the last 24 hours. I wanted to get back to one thing before we pick up on the United States, and that is the question of what would be necessary to bring down the death rate in Africa. One of the questions that comes up is personnel. I know we heard that Cuba is sending or has already sent 160 doctors. You mentioned the question of the hospital ships. Have you put together yet, or has anyone put together yet, what it would take in terms of personnel and also material to bring down the death rate in these three nations and stop the spread?
I don't have total numbers. It is true that Cuba has sent 167 physicians in there. I think it's very important to note that Cuba is the only government in the world that has sent physicians in there. And they're sending in another 100, as I understand it. We have not sent one single doctor to provide treatment. It's all being left to the relief agencies. And that is one of the issues that is raised. The fact that you simply do not have personnel. Doctors Without Borders has done an incredible job. And, you know, there's a big difference between the way that they operate and the way some of the relief agencies, while they're absolutely well-meaning, they're missionaries. And they don't have, they're involved in a humanitarian effort, but they don't have the kind of training. Doctors Without Borders they drill over and over again in terms of how to treat infectious disease before they send somebody into a situation like this. But they've completely reached the maximum capacity of what they can do. The question of getting trained medical personnel, physicians, physician's assistants, et cetera, in there is crucial, but right now, without treatment centers, it doesn't do you any good. If you want to bring down the death rate, then you have to treat this as a, you know, I've said this before, as have others who have worked in this field. Despite the claims by conspirophiles that, you know, this was cooked up somewhere, I don't have any evidence that it was. But what I do think is that we have to respond as if it were an act of biological warfare. And under those conditions, what you do is you take all of the expertise that has been developed by the United States, by Russia, by China, by Japan, especially in the wake of 9/11. And you use those capabilities, those biocontainment capabilities, in a crash way to deal with this. What does that mean? Well, it means that you would move those hospital ships in there. You would, instead of doing something like trying to build, you know, 17 treatment centers of 100 beds each. Look, these are countries that have very little infrastructure, but they're not complete wastelands. They do have buildings. Mm-hmm. Why not take over those buildings, take over the health ministries, et cetera, and as rapidly as possible, convert them into treatment centers, into hospitals with isolation wards as close to level 4 as you can get. If you do that and you do it quickly and you employ other biocontainment capacity that everyone has, then you can begin to contain the thing and bring down the death rate. And frankly, Harley, the situation is no different for the United States.
Right.
If you look at the thing here, we have 4 level 4 hospitals that have about 20 beds that are capable of treating infections like this. But we have a slew of level 3 hospitals that can be brought up to standard very quickly. It should be done now.
You know, it seems to me that this is one way for all those people who are thumping their chests and attacking Obamacare. This is a perfect way to reverse the effects of Obamacare by making this a national mission to upgrade the hospitals instead of tearing them down as it's been done under Obama.
Absolutely. You know, back in 2001, when everyone was very nervous about what the effect of the avian flu was likely to be, LaRouche called for a biological defense initiative. And there were many features to that, but one of the most obvious features was he called for an immediate upgrading of general hospitals, mm-hmm. because he said this is your first line of defense. I mean, these are the hospitals that treat the poor and the poor are always the highest risk demographic for the spread of any infectious disease. We were looking at that today, and I mentioned this in the interview that I did for LTAC. Well, you could talk about upgrading general hospitals, except that there are none.
They don't exist. The public hospitals right. have been turned into for-profit. This is privatization in the United States.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, we don't have the kind of deforestation that you see in Liberia, but the fact of the matter is that privatization does have its effect. And again, you know, you mentioned these people who are screaming about Obamacare. They scream about Obamacare, but they also want more privatization. You know, and hospitals that are hospitals for profit are really not going to act appropriately. We were discussing this, you know, the state of Maryland has more hospital beds per capita than any urban area in the United States. We don't have a single general hospital. Now, the legislature, in recognizing that, did in fact pass a body of legislation, which is in the right direction, saying that no emergency room in the state of Maryland could turn someone away if they didn't have health insurance. And that's a good law. But the problem is that under current circumstances, you have to ask, what's the efficacy of it? Does it work? Well, let's look at the case of Thomas Duncan. He showed up at Texas Presbyterian. They didn't say, go away, you don't have health insurance. They brought him in. They evaluated him. They created a chart. And they gave him Tylenol and sent him home. So under the current, even in places that have laws, like you have in Maryland, the hospital complied with that standard. And
now,
that's the problem.
I want to bring this up also, it could be because there was something that was reported in our briefing today on the change in the procedures that the CDC has mandated. I think we reported that, it's a New York Times article from a couple of days ago, which said that even though they were saying everything's adequate, we're taken care of, they issued more stringent guidelines. Is this going to take effect immediately in the United States, and is this adequate? I mean, what more has to be done in the U.S.?
Well, presumably, it's going to take place immediately. There's no capability for oversight, and it is also the case, and this is something that the nurses have all brought up, is that the training of nurses and medical paraprofessionals, hospital workers in general, is taking place right now on an ad hoc basis. Some places are doing it, others aren't, in terms of drills for how, in fact, you would deal with cases of highly infectious diseases. But, you know, when you say what's necessary, I think the first thing that's necessary, and, you know, I maintain this, and it's why I think that, you know, Obama and Anthony Fauci and some of the other mouthpieces for the administration should be for the international court on this. The situation is that you have to tell people, the first thing you have to do, you have to tell the truth. And right now, they're not doing that. They will not tell people the truth.
I think it was Dr. Osterholm, who said that if you want to avoid panic, tell people the truth and then face the reality, as opposed to spreading the lies, because when the lies are exposed, that's when you have real panic.
Exactly, and that's exactly what we're seeing now. You're seeing people who are completely hysterical, and rightfully so, because they know intuitively that they're being lied to. Anthony Fauci was on every network in the country saying nobody in the United States is going to die from Ebola. And then Thomas Duncan died. Then we were told that we had the ability to do contact tracing, that if, you know, some discrete case should show up, that measures would be in place immediately, that there's no way it would spread. But then, of course, again, what the Texas case shows is that we don't have those measures. I can't begin to tell you the number of people who have said to me, well, I'm confused. And these are people who actually tend to trust the government. They say, I'm confused. If this disease is not highly contagious, then why is it spreading so rapidly in Africa? Or if this isn't contagious, then how come when Dr. Brantley was brought back to America from West Africa, that those guys were wearing those hazmat suits and he was transferred in that capsule? This is a highly contagious disease. And, you know, Fauci will say, don't worry, it's not airborne. Well, you know, it's not airborne. But there are very few viruses that are airborne. Airborne has a very specific definition. And that is the ability of a virus or a bacteria to exist freely in the air without a host. Now, Ebola doesn't do that. But Ebola is present in high concentration in all of the bodily fluids of someone who is infected. That includes their saliva, their sputum, and their mucus. So that if the person doesn't have to vomit on you, the person doesn't have to bleed on you. Mm-hmm. The fact is that if you're exposed, especially in a confined space, like an airplane or like a classroom. I mean, how do children spread colds in a classroom? They sneeze on each other. They leave their snotty tissues in their desks. I mean, that's just life.
Yeah.
So this disease is not difficult to catch. It's one of the reasons why we have to immediately move to, first of all, not only train hospital personnel, but you have to give them adequate equipment. They have to have respirator hoods if they're going to treat someone with Ebola. One of the things that we do know from West Africa is that a very significant portion of the way healthcare personnel there have been infected is in the removal of their protective clothing. For anybody who's ever worn surgical gloves, if you double glove and you then, those things are damn hard to take off. They snap. And when they snap, the fluid droplets will hit your skin. You have to have adequate protective gear, like the hazmat suits that you see these individuals who are now transferring Ebola patients wear. Those are readily available. They are costly. You'd have to spend some money. It doesn't work if what you're thinking about is when the next round of sequestration is going to go through.
Well, this is where you see these conservatives thumping their chests about stopping flights into this country, because at the same time, they're continuing to cut the budget. And we're running short on time, so I want to just ask you a question that takes up actually your other hat that you wear as Mr. LaRouche's spokesman in Washington, D.C., where you've been very much involved for years in fighting for these policies. As you've been discussing this, the obvious point keeps coming up. We don't have a president who's committed to defending the American people. And we see the Congress going in all kinds of different directions. Everyone's focused on the midterm elections. And meanwhile, we have this crisis. It's obvious, Mr. LaRouche said, one of the other things that has to be done, besides the medical side of things, is to impeach Obama. Given the obvious incompetence and ridiculous policy with ISIS in the Middle East, the failure to address the banking crisis, and now this on top of it, a health crisis which threatens everyone, does that bring us closer to the possibility of getting Obama out?
Well, unless we're completely insane, it certainly should. The fact of the matter is that everything that this man has touched has turned to shit. And we have to be clear on that. The ISIS policy is a catastrophe. The way that this Ebola situation has been treated in Africa and at home is an atrocity. It's a crime against humanity. The fact is that a president who gets up and lies repeatedly to the American people is someone who has got to be held accountable. This morning, at the height of this epidemic, he did it again. He got up, he did his Saturday morning address, and he lied. Now, the question of whether we're closer to removing him, we certainly should be. And, you know, I said this in the interview with LPAC, and I will say it again. I've been very hard on the medical professionals who have done Obama's bidding, and I've certainly made my views clear on Obama himself. But at the end of the day, the American people have to take responsibility. And the fact is that the situation that we are in now is the result of the toleration of 50 years of very bad policy. But everything bad that's happened over that time period is condensed and concentrated in the 6-some-odd years that Obama has held the White House. Now, if we want international cooperation to contain this epidemic, if we want the equivalent of a global Manhattan Project to find a vaccine and a treatment, if we want to address the overall economic conditions that have led rise to this epidemic and will give rise to other epidemics in the immediate days ahead, then we have to realize that we can't do any of those things as long as Obama is in the presidency and as long as our policies are mirror images of the policies of British imperial genocidalists. And that's just the facts. So if the U.S. population doesn't like this, then they better do something about it now. And now probably you have a bill of impeachment with more potential articles of impeachment than I think anybody who has ever played a role in U.S. policy could imagine.
Now, Debbie, we're going to have to stop there because okay. We're out of time. But I think that last couple of minutes ought to send our listeners back to thinking through what you laid out in the first 58 minutes about how their lives are on the line. And if they don't act now, then they're not defending their own lives and those of their families, and they can't blame Obama for that. So,
absolutely.
Debbie, thanks for joining us. Thank you for joining us today. And as I mentioned earlier, you can see Deborah on the LaRouchePact.com. We'll be hearing a lot more from her in the days and weeks ahead as she and Mr. LaRouche craft a policy. But you've got to fight for it. So pick up the EIR, come onto the LPAC site, and then join us next week, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for the LaRouche Show. So, Debbie, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.